installment of the ABR podcast series. Today we have Kyle Chassé, a cryptocurrency blockchain industry veteran and technology entrepreneur who has founded, advised, and invested in numerous early-stage blockchain projects since his initial investment in Bitcoin in 2012. During 2013, Kyle founded World Super Loto, WSL, the world's first global lottery based on Bitcoin, and went all in on Bitcoin. In 2014, WSL went live, and Kyle used some of his Bitcoin gains to participate in the Ethereum ICO, followed by exploring infrastructure projects, making the investments in Bank to the Future, HungryX, Bitstamp, Kraken, Shapeshift, Coin Payments, and several others. In 2015, Kyle took on a full-time role as COO of Credits, built from scratch blockchain as a service, a BaaS company. In 2016, Kyle was deemed smart money by investors during this time period as he began lucratively analyzing, investing, and advising infrastructure and protocol projects from Coinbase, Eubanks, Bitfinex, Ultra, RNDR, and several others, holding impressive amounts of equity and tokens. Towards the end of 2018, Kyle founded Master Ventures, a blockchain advisory and think tank based in Copenhagen. MV combines the skills of several executives, each with a master skill set, and have all held C-level executive positions at various startups, hedge funds, VCs, and more. Master Ventures advises Tier 1 projects like SPL.YT, Eubanks, Even Network, Ultra.io, and Elrond. As the visionary of MV Think Tank, Kyle brings together the best-in-breed teams to build out blockchain infrastructure projects with the intention to bring legitimacy to the blockchain space. There are two products currently in the MV Think Tank pipeline: Crypto Exchange Alliance, CEA, which is a consortium of exchanges that will benefit from different service offerings. CEA offers among the service offerings include a cross-exchange order matching engine that will help bring liquidity to exchanges and increase volume for all via a global order book, and a universal API utilized for all exchanges. Ultimately, CEA will aid exchanges, allowing them to become sustainable, trusted, and transparent. House of DAO, HOD, is the WeWork WeLive of crypto based on Copenhagen, undergoing development. MV has hosted over 35 residents at Cryptopia, proof of concept for HOS on Copenhagen, with dozens of influential visitors such as Tone Base, Hen Global, Mike Chil Nai, Willy Wu, DD, the Bitcoin family. They've all visited the property to co-work and co-live on that paradise island. So that was a long introduction. Let's get into the questions. So Kyle, firstly, thank you for your time. At ABR, we're always looking for the movers and shakers in the world of blockchain. So how has 2020 been so far?
Thanks for the introduction, by the way. It's been one hell of a year. It's very exciting and weird at the same time. You know, my team and myself have been very fortunate to be locked down, like you said, in a paradise island, where in Thailand there's been extremely small cases of COVID. And on our island in Copenhagen, there hasn't been any reported cases ever. So we've been fairly isolated, and we're on a beautiful island with you know, great food and good people and good vibes. So it's hard for me to imagine what the rest of the world has gone through. I think, you know, the only area that has affected us, and now that the market's picked back up a bit, it seems like it wasn't even directly COVID. Just maybe the markets, but the area that we kind of were affected in is fundraising. But other than that, we know we've been building and going full steam ahead. You know, we have been largely unaffected.
So just moving on to the next question. So I guess that kind of leads into what you were saying just now about fundraising. Because like I was just wondering, like, you know, with the recent COVID situation and all that and the kind of complications, Has only fundraising been the main sort of factor in how it's affected your commercial operations so far?
Yeah, well, yes and no. Also, we, you know, as you kind of mentioned, we're planning on launching House of DAO, which is a blockchain-focused incubation village, co-working, co-living. We ran a proof of concept back in 2018 that was very successful. And we would have liked to have launched it, by now this year. And obviously, it doesn't make sense to do that without the borders opening up. So that's been a bit of a delay. But I guess it's a blessing that we didn't open it, you know, pre-COVID. That would have been a disaster. So we're just patiently waiting, and we're working on Crypto Exchange Alliance in the meantime. So yeah, that's kind of the area that's been affected.
Right. So from your perspective, how do you think the journey of digital development has been going so far in your organization, like just in terms of the digital transformation and it's also the human transformation that kind of goes along with that. Could you maybe give our listeners a bit of a snapshot on how things are coming along with Master Ventures right now?
Yeah, so I'm not sure exactly what the question is, but I think we've been I think I answered a little bit too in my last question, but we are, like you said, digital development. You know, we're an internet based team. All of the team members except for our development team is based here in Thailand with me, and our developers are decentralized around the world. And so everything, like I said, everything has been remained fairly undisturbed with this whole chaotic year of 2020 so far. But the market's going up, and that's been exciting for all of us. It's a bit distracting, actually, just because it's very exciting now to think that maybe we've entered into a bull market, and to be fully aware and learning lessons from the previous bull markets, kind of. Making sure that we're properly placed and positioned for this next run-up.
I was just reading a few articles recently, and I was also looking through your YouTube channel as well. And some of the topics that seem to be on the mind of everyone these days has a lot to do with the way Bitcoin's value is kind of going up, and there's a lot of talk about how things are going along in the US with the way they are just rushing out a lot of stimulus packages and rescue
money.
Packages.
Yep.
And all this is kind of it's contributing towards a deflationary sort of perspective on the US dollar, and I guess just on most fiat currencies now worldwide. And investors are saying that cryptocurrencies could be on the up, and you've got outliers who are saying stuff like even gold and silver could be really good investments going forward and all that. How do you see this ecosystem right now with we've got decentralization, we've got DeFi going on, we've got a lot of stablecoin sort of action happening as well. What's your perspective on how things are, at least for this year, and how we may, look forward to, investment portfolios, that kind of thing? Where do you see everything right now?
Well, at first I was really skeptical about the Fed, continuing to print money and just, the continuously printing and inflating the money supply. I thought initially when things just got obvious that the underlying economies of the world were in shambles, with the skyrocketing unemployment and things like that, I really thought that the markets were going to just plummet. And that's kind of what should have happened. And I was really surprised that they didn't. They were saved by the Federal Reserve, and I think that this actually makes it really good, because if the markets had had plummeted, the crypto market would have went with it. It's correlated, fairly correlated. I think we're seeing a decoupling now, but definitely in the first half of the year, it was extremely correlated. We saw that in March with the drop. And if it had continued, if the Fed didn't step in and just say, whoa, we're going to print a bunch of money right now, we would have seen the markets continue to decline, all of them, and it would have been a bloodbath. However, I think what's interesting right now is the Fed is going to have to print a lot more money in order to kind of continue stimulus and continue to try to float the economy. I don't think that can last forever. Eventually, you have to get into hyperinflation because the underlying economy is so bad. But I think it really puts us in a good position as Bitcoiners and cryptocurrency enthusiasts and really believers. Whereas there's enough warning now that this is probably going to happen, and people who foresee it happening, I mean a collapse or a hyperinflation of a dollar, they're in a better position to prepare for something like this. So they're looking for hedges against a hyperinflation of US dollar or a bubble popping of stock markets and real estate and things like that, which eventually it will, because we're seeing, you know, the most unrealistic and nonsensical type of market movements. You know, how does the market hit all-time highs? I'm talking about traditional markets. How do they hit all-time highs when the economy they're representing is pretty much the worst since the Great Depression? It doesn't make any sense. So why I think this is interesting is because people are looking for alternatives, and we've seen now a flee into gold. And Bitcoin is digital gold. And I think that is a very good representation of what it is. It's a scarce asset that has it's even more scarce than gold. And more people are starting to put it on their radar, starting to understand it. So it's good that we have this time for people to better place themselves as a hedge for the bubbles popping and the dollar inflating and things like that. So I think it's beautiful the way that it worked out for those of us who see the potential for Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies as a hedge against what's going on. I guess that's I know that answers the first part of your question. I don't remember what the rest was, but that's I think a very interesting point to make.
I'm just looking at your YouTube channel, and your latest one was about the Elrond mainnet launch. Do you think you could give us a bit of an overview on the significance of this mainnet launch?
Yeah, so I was an advisor for Elrond back before they did their IEO, working on their monetary and fiscal policy as well as token economic models. And I got to know the team pretty well, and I know that the team is they are very ambitious and they are executors, and the project ran their testnet when they did Battle of the Nodes, which was basically meant to really stress test the network, and they got up to 260,000 transactions per second in the testnet environment, which, as we know, a testnet is just the precursor to mainnet, which is now live. And we see this ultra demand for smart contracts, right? DeFi and games and things like that, and other use cases for smart contracts. When the Ethereum network is not capable of handling these transactions, you know, the Ethereum network is backed up. You know, people are spending $1, $2, $3, $4, $5, $6, even $10 for gas fees on an Ethereum contract. So what this is doing is it's putting a lot of pressure on Ethereum and making there's an opening now for a more efficient blockchain solution to come that can facilitate smart contracts. And this is why I think that it's going to be interesting, because there's plenty of room for other smart contract platforms to now kind of rise to the top. And I just see, and I think Elrond is special because you know, people say it all the time, you could have the best technology in the world and maybe it doesn't become the one that the world uses. And that has a lot to do with marketing. And I have never seen a better marketing department than Elrond's marketing department. So I'm really bullish on this project. They're building in DeFi space and gaming and, you know, do all kinds of partnerships. They move incredibly fast. So that's kind of my two cents about Elrond.
Yeah, I mean, when I watched the video of your presentation, like especially its ecosystem, it's like they seem to have really added a lot of players really quickly, right? They really seem to be on the cusp of something big. There's another thing that I wanted to just kind of touch on. China recently launched their blockchain network back in April, right? And they're also kind of pushing for a central bank digital currency. They have like a digital yuan. We've got like a very diversified sort of future that's coming up, right? I mean, you'll probably have China having a sort of a global blockchain infrastructure with Chinese characteristics. And then you've got some stable coins that make you up to the mix. Then you've got IEOs, ICOs, SDOs. A lot of this is going to be complicating the marketplace, right, to a large extent. What would you, what do you think about the central bank digital currencies? Do you think that they're really going to be quite useful, or are they just going to be, like substitutes of just normal fiat currencies, just so that it's cashless and contactless?
No, I think it depends on what perspective you're looking at, what lens you're looking at this from. So if you're looking at this from a state level, as in Chinese government, it's extremely useful. It'll be much more efficient than the current systems. Right now, banks connect to each other through SWIFT network, and you have incredibly slow times for settlements of cross-border payments and things like that. Everything is using SWIFT infrastructure, which was built a very long time ago. And so when you're using some type of distributed network technology, I'm not going to call it a blockchain, because central bank digital currencies hardly qualify as a blockchain. They might be distributed in some respect, but it's probably not really distributed. And that's why it's called central bank. And then if you look at this through the people's perspective of China, this is like a dystopian type of idea where if you get rid of cash, you get rid of people's ability to be anonymous. The saying of cash under the bed for a rainy day or emergencies, that goes away. You become completely under the control of the government, where they get to have complete visibility of all your transactions, everything you're doing financially. They can cut you off at any time they want to. So it becomes a bit scary, and you really become a slave of that ecosystem or that country. It becomes really, really kind of, like I said, dystopian when you talk about central bank digital currencies, in my opinion. So to answer your question, it makes it incredibly more efficient as a country. And when you talk about China versus something like the United States, which this seems to be the two countries that are kind of battling it out right now from a technology perspective and an economic perspective, the U.S. dollar, there's like lots of people coming out right now saying that the U.S. dollar may lose its place as the world reserve currency. Goldman Sachs is saying this, and other big analysts publicly coming out and saying this, and they wouldn't be saying that if they didn't really believe it's probably going to happen. And China is putting themselves in a very interesting place where they're building the One Belt One Road or One Belt Initiative, where they're building a trade pathway all the way from China to Europe, going through a bunch of, 27 different countries or something like that, which I think it's road and railway. I don't know for sure. But it's going to allow, the transportation and importing and exporting of goods much more efficiently than having to do a boat and things like that. So they're going to be able to open up trade with all these different countries in all of Asia and Europe, and be able to circumvent the United States and circumvent these long journeys over the ocean and things like that. So China has been setting themselves up to be like an economic global superpower for quite some time. And they got a head start on the central bank digital currency. And right now, the States is threatening to cut off America from the SWIFT network. And China is, they have their, they're preparing for that. They're just like Huawei was, it's never been to their surprise when the States tries to cut them off from something. When the United States cut off Huawei from Google, they're like, well, we kind of have been anticipating this. Therefore, we have this backup ecosystem. And China has never been able to trust the United States as far as relying on in their infrastructure like Swift Network. And so they've been preparing for this as well. It's an interesting thing ahead. You know, I think that the United States is definitely going to lose their place as the world reserve currency. It's been a long time coming, and traditionally, historically, every major world reserve currency tends to come to an end after a century. You know, and I think U.S. dollar has been kind of world reserve currency for about 107 years or something like that. So it's a bit overdue. And you can only build a monetary system based on debt with something like Federal Reserve banking system for so long before it fails. Debt just, it's impossible to get out of debt with the way that the U.S. dollar is the monetary system in the U.S. dollar. With the Federal Reserve printing money and lending it to the states at interest, it makes it impossible to get out of debt. And the more and more that's printed, the more debt that we get into, and just becomes impossible to dig ourselves out of that. So it's inevitable.
Yeah. Just on the U.S. perspective, the former SEC chairman, Jay Clayton, he did mention that, you know, like most of these crypto sort of investments and, you know, like ICOs and IEOs, they were all kind of lumped as securities, right? You always looked at it as securities. Just based on your experience and what you hear from the experts, what's it like in the U.S. for, blockchain sort of projects and like crypto-based kind of initiatives, which are like, you know, ICOs and IEOs? Is it really a good place to do projects in the U.S.?
And there's a reason why I left the United States when I started becoming more public in blockchain, right? Like, I grew up there. I traveled a lot, but and my early days in the industry were fairly private. I didn't really talk about it much. You know, when I did the World Super Lotto, it was kind of this was long before eyes were on the industry. And in 2016 and 17, when there started to be more regulators putting their eye on the industry, and I knew that I wanted to be more involved, more actively and publicly involved, I decided that it's probably not best for me to be in the United States. And whenever I talk to different projects, advising them or anything like that, I'm just like, you need to try to separate the United States from your business. There's plenty of money in the rest of the world. There's plenty of customers in the rest of the world. You know, you don't need to focus on the states. Like, focus, you know, domicile yourself in a jurisdiction that's friendly to what you're doing and cater to an audience that doesn't have this lunacy of a government that comes out that thinks that they can really control everybody in the entire world. You know, it's ridiculous. When I go to open any type of account somewhere or do articles of incorporation or taxes in different countries for different businesses that we have, you know, the one on every single form, there's one country they care about if you reside in or have tax obligations to. That's the United States, you know. And this idea of STOs versus ICOs, they don't like ICOs because ICO is an unregulated kind of crowd offering. And that is scary to them because you're doing something two things that they don't like. One, it could be disruptive, which is scary to them. And two, doesn't mean that you haven't vouched or you haven't promised to pay taxes for what you're doing, you know? So I always encourage everybody to avoid the United States as much as possible when dealing with this in this industry.
Right. This is actually a question that I put to another industry insider recently. There was a study that revealed by 2024 the market of security tokens will much likely exceed that of cryptocurrencies and will be expected to reach 1.5 trillion in the European Union, the EU. A report by the World Economic Forum also suggested that by 2027, 10% of the global GDP will rest on blockchain technology. So following this methodology, this study will projects that the market of tokenized assets will be worth nearly 24 trillion in financial assets alone by 2027. Now, a lot of this sounds like, pretty much hyperbole. Maybe it's not really accurate. But do you think the market for security tokens would really expand or at least really exponentially increase, you think, in the future?
Yeah, 100%. I think that study is talking about not only security tokens, but also any type of digital asset. So you're talking about, security tokens or utility tokens, digitized, securitized equity. It's about like blockchain and digitized assets are all about increasing efficiency. When you're talking, if you want to trade Forex, for example, and you're doing foreign exchange trading, to do a settlement for those transactions cross jurisdiction takes 2 days. 2 days to settle between broker to broker. And that's just unacceptable in a modern world where everything is done on computer screens with virtual digital numbers. I would understand if they had a ship, a airplane full of Japanese yen and Thai baht and US dollars physically across the world. Okay, 2 days might make sense in that case. But the fact is that there's no physical assets being sent anywhere. So why does it take 2 days to do a settlement? Why does it take 3 to 5 days on a SWIFT network to transfer from bank to bank? This is unacceptable in 2020, completely unacceptable. So I think that everything that can be traded will be turned into a digital asset and traded across digital asset exchanges.
Yeah. There was another thing about real estate tokenization. That there was also a prediction that the real estate market will probably attract something like 4.2 trillion in revenue through tokenization by the year 2025. Do you think that seems probable?
Depends where the revenue is coming from. If they anticipate revenue coming from appreciation of the real estate assets, I don't know, because I think real estate market is in a bubble right now. But if they're talking about generating revenue from service fees, transaction fees, commissions, things like that, maybe that's true. But that number, it sounds to me they're probably anticipating it on the. It's hard to know what they're talking about in that study without reading it, but that really would be dependent, I guess, on the market of real estate, But if it's just talking about setting up the infrastructure for securitizing real estate, then that's possible, I guess. I'm not sure.
Yeah. There was another sort of kind of element to that. When we talk about financial assets like company stocks, equity or VC funding, the whole idea of tokenization allows for greater flexibility. It allows for rapid settlements and efficient processes too, right? And of course, investors can kind of diversify their portfolios and the whole fractional ownership concepts. These are all like pretty much game changers. So how do you think all this plays out in your book? Like, are people really that, educated about all this? Do you think there's a real struggle for the masses to really get on board?
I don't think people are educated about it yet. And that just comes with over a matter of time before institutions that can educate their investors and different companies that set up to do things like crowdfunding, that is what will educate the masses. I think that it's definitely going to be welcomed with open arms. If you would have told me back when I was out of college that I could have invested in a piece of property with $1,000 or $100. And I wouldn't have owned all of it, but I would have had a fractional ownership. And if that thing appreciated, then I would be able to benefit from that. I would be interested in that. And I think most people would. Everyone wants to own real estate, but not everybody can afford to own real estate. So I think the idea of fractional ownership makes perfect sense.
Yeah. There were a few, I just had a few other sort of queries on this. Just moving on towards the decentralized economy. Concepts like the Facebook's Libra project, it was definitely touted as a poster child for the decentralized economy paradigm. And now you've got new players like Celo as well. What's your take on Facebook's Libra project? Do you think it's got the right sort of fundamentals going forward?
Well, it's from what I understand, it's a lot has changed recently with the model. They had to make it more United States patriotic and friendly. So I think the original idea that they had made a lot more sense, where you take a basket of different currencies and kind of take the weighted average of them and create a stable currency based on that. But now it seems like, and I haven't done a ton of research on this, but it seems like now they're saying they're going to peg it to the US dollar, and that defeats the purpose, in my opinion. So what's more interesting is when you look at a project like Ampleforth, for example, that is taking an elastic money supply, which is what, you know, I think that we need based on supply and demand in order to keep the price stable. So if you look at a project like Ampleforth, they peg their price target of the currency to the 2019 US dollar based on consumer price index, which also has some flaws in it, but it's probably better than what we're looking at when we're talking about hyperinflation from the US dollar right now. Like, I only keep a bit of US stable coin on hand, a little bit at a time, because I know that it's losing value every single day. But if a project like Ampleforth were to take off and reach like adoption, it would generally stay a very stable type of currency because it has an elastic supply and it's based on an algorithm versus, you know, a centralized authority that can just print more at will. So I think that type of idea makes more sense than something like Libra. I mean, Libra only makes sense from an adoption perspective because there's, 3 billion people on Facebook. So that would be pretty insane. But I don't think the Libra idea makes as much sense as it used to.
Yeah, I was just wondering, at ABR, we've focused on, blockchain systems within supply chain finance systems for corporate networks and fintech systems, and we have quite a B2B focus. So I was just wondering, what's your opinion on, some of the issues that kind of revolve around crowdfunding capital as well, because blockchain systems, as we all know, can provide efficiency, trust, and transparency through decentralization and disintermediation as well to build more robust economies. How do you think crowdfunding capital could really be changed as a result?
I mean, I love the idea of crowdfunding. It was I've been an entrepreneur all my life, and when I was, my late teens, early 20s, I had some ideas and I wanted to build businesses out of them, and, started learning about how businesses get built and the fact that the typical path is a friends and family round. Okay, that makes sense. That's kind of like crowdfunding. But then you go to the angel round, and they take a fairly substantial chunk of equity, and then if you have some success, then you have to go to the next round, which is VCs, and they take a huge chunk of equity. And eventually, you're left with a very small percentage of your dream, your company, and you also don't have full control anymore. And I think that whole thing is very discouraging for a lot of people. And, you've seen a lot of founders of companies eventually exit the company, even if it does well, because it turned into something that they didn't intend it to turn into. Maybe it did well, but they exited. Like, this is why I think why Elon Musk left PayPal. He wanted PayPal to be Bitcoin, basically. And he wasn't able to do that because of regulatory and because they didn't have the proper tech, and they didn't go about it like Satoshi did. But, his vision was different than what PayPal turned out to be. And so crowdfunding reserves the power for the founders and allows you to raise a little bit of money from tons of people that get very, very small stake in the company, not enough to have voting rights usually. And it also allows people with a far less amount of money who believe in what you're doing, it gives them an opportunity to believe in you and put a little bit of their hard-earned cash into what you're building. So, I mean, this is why I really like the idea of an ICO. I think that they can be improved. through something like a DICO model, which is like basically just a crowdfunding platform with a governance model. And you know, and I think even as much as I am anti-regulation and especially stringent regulation, I still think that security token crowdfunding will disrupt the traditional VC equity funding space.
Right. Okay. We'll just go to the. We'll finish up just a few general sort of questions. So 2020 has been quite a year. So what would you put as, you know, like some of the lessons you've learned so far, maybe some key insights and key learnings from the kind of projects that you've been involved so far?
Well, I think, you know, it's been one thing that's been very interesting that kind of I found out on my own. You know, I've invested in, I guess, close to 50 different projects since 2013 and 2012, if you include Bitcoin. And I've invested in all different stages of projects. You know, I typically lean toward more early stage, but I've invested in some later stages as well. And I didn't really think about it, but every time that I've invested into an early stage project, like very early, like seed round or something, I have almost always met the founding team before I deployed capital into that project. And I never really thought about it before. That just felt normal to me. And then this year, we were raising money for Crypto Exchange Alliance. And it's a really good idea with a very strong go-to-market, a great team, tons of traction. And we were raising money. I thought initially it would be no problem, you know. But in the age of COVID, and especially us living on an island, I didn't have the ability to go face-to-face with investors. And it was proving very challenging for us to be able to raise money. And finally, it occurred to me one day, I started asking questions on these investor calls. I said, you know, have you ever deployed capital into an early stage company that you haven't met face to face? And pretty much across the board, the answer was no. Occasionally, I started getting something like, we haven't before, but we just did our first, or we never have, but we're starting to realize we might have to. These kinds of answers. So I guess one of the things I can share with the listeners is if that you're raising money and you really believe in what you're doing, if you have the opportunity to get face to face with an investor, you're probably going to have infinitely more success than trying to do it over a phone call or a video call. And so I think that's one of the most interesting things I've learned all year. The rest of it has been just... I've been, you know, focused on what we're building in-house and also trying to make sense of what's going on in the world as well. And I really don't know who to believe. There's all kinds of different information about there, and none of it seems to make a whole lot of sense. And so I've been trying to decipher.
Yeah. I think that comes to my, that brings me to my final question. What do you see in your crystal ball? Like where is everything going next? I mean, like, you know, we've talked about the deflationary sort of, market rumblings, or at least the way things are going on with fiat currencies, especially with the US dollar. And, you've got China doing their thing with a blockchain network, with Chinese characteristics, but it can go global. Everyone's a bit, I guess the risk averse sort of investors would not really want to get into, you know, Bitcoin or any cryptocurrencies or stable coins and all that. But like you said, something's got to give at some point, right? So coming back to it, what do you see in your crystal ball for 2020 and beyond?
I think for this year, I think that things are going to keep going exactly the way that they have been. You know, there's not going to be a lot of clarity on anything. The Federal Reserve has no choice but to continue to print money. Otherwise, you're going to have civil unrest in America with, you know, you thought the riots were bad over, over, what's his name? Rod, what is his name? Whatever. you know, he thought that the Black Lives Matter movement was bad. Wait until people start starving with no money. There's going to be crime like you wouldn't believe. So they need to at least continue to print money until they have a quote unquote cure for this whole thing. You know, whether people believe that this is a serious virus or not, that's a whole nother topic on its own. But the mainstream narrative is that this is a really bad pandemic and it's a race to find this vaccine. And then, you know, this whole thing is crazy, in my opinion, you know, but then the question then becomes, you know, do they force the vaccinations on people? And it feels to me like it will not be much of an option, you know, which is crazy. Like that scares the hell out of me in itself. But yeah, so and the Fed is going to have to print a lot of money to get to that point. You know, they're talking about this vaccine optimistically at the end of the year. However, I don't think that's going to happen. But sometime in Q1, maybe next year. So I see things happening exactly the way they are. And the longer it gets dragged out and the more red flags that people get, the more they're going to look for options in case of a collapse, in case of hyperinflation. And the more Bitcoin becomes on people's radars and the more, you know, people start talking about this, the more that they're going to look for, you know, alternatives. And that's where Bitcoin will come in. It's a digital gold, you know, and we've seen gold go to all-time highs. And I think that, you know, the best place that people can be looking is to, you know, invest into Bitcoin, put their savings there, not, you know, or put some, at least a good amount in there. And yeah, I don't know, man, it seems crazy to me, the whole situation globally. It's really hard to believe what's going on out there. And like I said, I've been isolated on a beautiful island and really don't have firsthand experience with what the rest of the world is experiencing. But yeah, I think, you know, one thing that's been interesting is that we're building House of DAO here in the island too, which is, like I said, this co-working, co-living blockchain hub. And we pay attention to the trends. And one thing that COVID has done is it accelerated the evolution of work from home or work remotely. You know, places like Twitter and things like that said, you guys never have to come back to the office ever again. And that makes a whole, that's very interesting. You know, it's liberating for people. You know, now you can work from anywhere in the world with your laptop and an internet connection, which frees you up to travel and things like that, which is really nice. And so we are excited about that for House of DAO. We think that it's going to, you know, improve the appeal for House of DAO. People can, you know, come and work on their projects at our beautiful location, and we're happy to have them. And so, yeah, I think it's going to be a weird rest of the year, and I have no idea what's going to happen, but I'm paying attention to find out.
How is House of DAO coming along? I mean, are you guys what's the completion rate at now?
Yeah, we're ready. Once borders open up, we're ready to go. You know, we're just waiting. We're just waiting for borders to open up before we open our doors.
Okay, good stuff. All right, Kyle, it's been a great chat. We definitely hope to get you on soon for a follow up. Sure. But yeah, but till then, thank you very much for your time, Kyle.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Bye. See you.
Bye bye.